Foreign Madam and the White Yogi, a verse novel by Chris Mooney Singh, Chapter 1, Prologue. A woman's face, last seen in bone ash, mixes with the river's ebb and flow. Between the dunes and shoulder bends that change a shifting course from flash monsoon to floodplain every year. Revealed in swirling current and push of poles, men cast out their nets along the banks like cloaks to clothe her shy soul nakedness, but cannot see. She drips down through green gauze as now they haul those silver tails from sand. His loss is less, that she is long past forms, her shape a river pulse, a mind, an engine of wetness bigger than the past. The push of flood-locked muscle brings her down into the silt and muck of death, croaking to life inside each marshland frog. Beneath his feet, the bone ash stirs black ink, and soon sharp pens, cross-cut from reeds, will sketch a village school on putties, boards of plywood daubed with white. She's not just here in water, sky and wind. Who she is won't fade away at all, like an old birthmark tattooed on his chest. While inside, she is flapping like a jackdaw, cawing code words repetitive to bring her back to him. That's all. He only has this way of metaphor to bake the sand into a face and draw her eyes and nose with a stick in river silt. And so he enters the hologram kingdom of the word. And so one story nestles in another. The headline show escaped a velvet theatre by the Torrens River. Every coughing car dragged on in convoy to the nine-hour epic of passion, power and its holocaust. The snake of headlights slithering up a hill 17 kilometres from the city, charting Mount Lofty's bitumen bends to Clopper's Quarry. Hard-bitten from a pre-Cambrian mound, this freestone site had transmigrated to another time, sand-packed hard to make a red earth stage, with burning wicks in terracotta dishes and one brass ghee lamp lit to heat the hand that touches it, a namaste to the light before and in the middle and in the end of this mash-up saga from an Indian yuga. Long passed on from tongue to ear to tongue and written in scriptology from the gods, the ancient slokas, couplets running inked on bamboo strips before the age of paper, would not be chanted in a three-tone scale, but channeled here in English by a cast of international actors playing gurus, brothers, lovers, mothers. A wide gene pool from England, Europe, Africa, Japan, along with India's own. That night assembled in a mock-up amphitheatre scaffolded with ascending planks, 800 were now nestled under blankets on the bleachers after champagne flights. And yet, despite the scent of eucalyptus, this might have been a village from 5,000 years ago, a caravanserai for 15 nights, with a story epic as this continent. The audience was filing in, equipped for an all-night campout from the great indoors with coats and cushions, picnic grub and rugs. It was hot autumn, with a cold night chill, especially in the hills above the plains. A strain of female laughter stabbed the air, already squeezed and giggling under wraps. Someone said, "Oh, come on, shush, she's starting." "Go fuck yourself," regaled a male mantra. Meanwhile, a single woman on her plank in red wool coat and draped with a tartan rug was fidgeting to find her comfort spot, self-conscious in this enclave of love couples and her aloneness. Best friend Deborah's child had vomited fish and rice and peas all day. There'd been no time to scalp or even gift the premium ticket, so dearest Deb reneged and let her good friend drive up here alone. Such rare outings were negotiations with babysitters or the phantom dads, and going solo was no comfort zone. Although she was no weeper, having been the farthest girl of three from mother's love with a father who passed early that warm lap. Tonight she was snuggling among the festive in a place inadequate, exposed with all these membrane wings of tiny bats flitting about her head like evil spirits of boyfriends past. The rows were filled and chatting, yet still there was a vacant space beside her where Deborah's generous buttocks should have been, as now a latecomer looking at a ticket, then row numbers, climbing until at last he, a bearded ponytail, switched on his twilight vision to the vacant spot. "Is this seat taken?" He leaned toward her answer. Why should she refuse the man? The epic play was just about to start. Reticence paused, but then she said, "I guess." Glad it would not seem she was alone. "Thanks," he answered, taking squatter's rights. Playing the polar guy, he zipped his jacket and, sitting while pretending not to look, glanced at her with his peripheral thoughts. Still a stranger, as yet unmet and awkward, he couldn't read her in this tight fit squeeze without some thinking space. It was showtime, without a curtain, just the dimming lights. All were craning forward to the stage, an obedient, well-heeled audience. They heard a Sol Tanpura droning somewhere and kept quiet. Dark faded up to bright. And thus the festival headline act began. A small boy enters, looking here and there, lost as a song without a singer, walking between the burning lamps until he spots a ragged rishi with long beard and dreadlocks. Sitting in full lotus, his eyes open, and seeing the lad brighten as he asks, "Can you write?" The boy says, "No." Then, "Why?" "I have composed a poem. It's all up here," touching his forehead. "A great poem, yes, I've composed it all, but none is written yet. I need someone to set down what I know." "What's your name?" the forthright boy then asks.
"My name's Vyasa."
"What's your poem about?"
"It's about you."
"Me?"
"Yes, it is the saga of your race and how your ancestors were born, how they grew, and how a vast war fanned the flames of a funeral pyre. It is the poetical history of mankind, and if you listen very carefully, at the end you will be someone else." The ponytail upon the plank now saw Sri Ganesha, elephant-headed god, also scribe, who had arrived here jingling tiny bells around his ankled feet.
"Ganesha, welcome!"
Vyasa is most glad to greet the son of Shiva, who now speaks.
"Rumour has it you are looking for a scribe to write down the poetical history of mankind. I am at your service."
An elephant can trumpet through all problems. Invoked at the inauguration of a job, he's good luck, and hence good value for a devotee who makes an offering. Or so the ponytail, who wore a beard, had read, being fond of Indian books. Mr. Ponytail craned firmly forward. She saw him without seeming to and noted. There was a squint of concentration there as she nibbled like a squirrel on her morsel.
"So, are you really Ganesha?" asks the boy.
"Yes, Ganesha in person."
Seating himself, opening a book.
"I'm ready. Let's begin."
He likes the lad and calls him to his side.
"Come, sit down here."
Ganesha pats the ground. Meanwhile, at a loss, the sage Vyasa cannot proceed.
There is something secret about a beginning. I don't know how to start."
"May I make a suggestion?" asks the scribe.
"Please."
"Well, as you claim sole authorship of the poem, why not start with you?"
"Right."
Viesa sees the sense and speaks. "A Raja hunting in the forest fell asleep. He dreamed his bride's red fingertips were the colour of her bearded lips below, and so there was a joyful surge of sperm."
"Ah, very good start," Ganesh eggs him on.
"Well, when the Raja woke and saw the jism glistening on a leaf, he called a falcon. 'Take it to the queen.' But then the bird, struck by another falcon, dropped the sperm into the river. A redfish gulped it down. A fisherman soon caught and gutted it, finding a girl as tiny as a pearl." The audience craned their heads again to see the tadpole tiny infant on his palm. 800 want to sigh, and so Ganesh does it for them. The ponytail smiled a shooting glance. She nodded back.
He's quite cute, she thought. I like this guy, his small black bird of beard and tied back hair. But let's not get too vampish, greedy girl.
The grubby sage Viasa carries on. Her name was Satyavati. She grew up but smelled of fish. This made her very sad. None would come near her. But then one day a hermit by the river saw her moping.
"I like you. Let's make love here right away. I promise I will turn this horrid stink into the delicate scent of the champa flower."
Shy as a deer, she said, "I can't. Not here." And so the hermit wrapped her in thick mist, enveloping the river and the fields. She opened herself to him, and doing so became most fragrant, irresistible.
"So did she have a son?" the boy inquires.
"Yes, I am that son, Viasa." "Son of the mist, go on," Ganesh butts in. "We haven't started. Now, tell it as it was from the beginning."
Viasa stops beneath the theatre lights and, staring outward to the audience, thinks back in time. "It was a golden age. There was no war, no misery, and men were close to the gods."
Blue wash of light came up. The audience creaked upon its planks, and the ponytail's face was beaming clearly, rising in the dawn light from the stage. She looked around. Still, it was all night black. Strange, she thought. He's glowing like the moon. Feeling a shiver right up through her skull. A bell rings. A man in robes and scarf enters the stage to sit before a fire and make an offering of sandalwood mixed with sweet ghee, pleasing to the gods. Sage Viesa continues to narrate.
"Once there was a prince whose name was Bhishma. A perfect prince, clear-minded, noble, strong, but was not king."
"Why not?" asked the boy. "Because he couldn't marry or have children."
"But why? I don't understand," he asks again.
"Because the king had cast his eyes upon Satyavati and he burned for her."
"Your mother Satyavati?"
The boy looks shocked. "Your mother's story is quite intimate," comments Ganesh.
"Any objection?"
"No, no objection at all. So did she marry the king, Bhishma's father?" probes the god.
The ponytail nodded, his bearded chin murmuring audible approval. The right-hand couple looked at him askance, fidgeting on their portion of the plank, but he was somewhere else, envisioning a sadhu wandering in Bhishma robes. Such was his dream to go to India and merge his Aussie raindrop in that ocean. Gradually, Viasa grows the poem. "Satyavati wouldn't marry, lest her sons inherited the throne. So noble Bhishma, for father's happiness, stepped aside. To avoid all discord, he declared an oath of complete renunciation. I abjure. I disavow the love of woman.
He said that?
In all solemnity, replies Fiesa. And the gods applauded. Very pleased, they gave the ability to choose his time of death.
It's possible?
Asked the boy. It was back then. Crimson Coat shifted on the plank, having heard her neighbours murmuring. Oh yes, she understood this kind of hunger aroused by Bhishma's act of sacrifice, and oh, she liked the pony more for it. She imagines him beside her going home and tips him naked onto her futon bed, then puts the scene on pause.
What are you thinking? You're an idiot. Just get a grip.
Vyasa's tail was running on the stage.
Satyavati's sons? Inquires Ganesha.
Yes, one weakling, but you know, in olden times, if a king wanted to marry, he had to win a tournament for a wife. But then this king was far too feeble to take part, so Bhishma battled in his place and swept the field and came back with three wives instead of one. The youngest one was weeping in her shawl. Bhishma asks her, Amber, why these tears? Amber confesses of her secret love beaten in the tournament, King Salva. Bhishma gives her leave to go to him, who rejects her.
You are Bhishma's prize and soiled goods. Amber, I don't want you.
She begs and tells.
But I'm still a virgin.
It is too late. Yes, he is scared of Bhishma.
Amber, leave. You don't exist for me.
Rejection is an acid slice of gourd, a bitter bite of bark. The red-coat woman had her old thoughts, but they were black.
Who said you could just come? Who said you have the right to turn up here and now? Get lost, you creeps,
she told herself, looking round embarrassed. Salty trails were running down each cheek. He saw and offered her a crumpled hanky. She took it and then dabbed the double fountains. Are you okay? He whispered. Nodding back, she was so grateful for the little kindness and drew a hand outside her tartan rug, offering him her bag of trail mix. He turned and saw her eyes. It broke his dream of renunciation in one sensual second. Who was this woman crying without warning? Involuntarily, he scooped his hand and drew out nuts, dried coconut, papaya, and like a mendicant receiving alms, bowed his head and hands in namaste. Now the boy on stage inquires further,
So did the Raja wed the two princesses?
He did, but died upon his wedding night, and so there were no children, says Vyasa.
But without children, this tale can't go on, adds Ganesha.
Precisely, says Vyasa.
So the poetical history of mankind was over.
And with that, Ganesha starts to close the book. Vyasa intercepts, flicking back the pages with his hand.
Fortunately, my mother found a way. It was up to me to do the necessary.
So now Vyasa moves to center stage to become a character in his drama and kneels down before the sour princess. She doesn't like this ragged-looking rishi with dirty dreadlocks and a face of ashes.
Why did you close your eyes? Because I'm ugly? Because you turned away, your son will be known as Dhritarashtra, the blind.
A spotlight probes as Sri Ganesha comes, walking onto stage.
But a true-born king cannot be born bat-blind. This will not do. So what happened with the second princess?
New lights crossfade upon another set, spread with carpets. As Vyasa enters, the second princess thinks she's seen a ghost.
Why is your colour draining away? He asks. Am I so loathsome? You'll also have a son, but he'll be white as milk and will be known as Pandu the Pale, the pun lover's father.
Sipping, they strolled. The night was chilly. A new breeze was rattling leaf and gumpod, and this cool change seemed charged with nervousness, pausing the pool between them as they noted the audience banter and light-headed wine. Then finally he blurted out his name. I'm sorry, I'm Yogi. I should have said before, but did not tell how he'd earned the name. Neither would she probe him then and there.
Well, I'm Margaret. Oh, call me Margot. I go by both, she offered in fair trade.
Really glad we've met. Quite unexpected. Thanks for giving up the seat. I guess there must have been some double booking problem.
Well, I'm glad I came as well. I don't know much about the story. It's a bit confusing.
What don't you understand? He asked, concerned.
Well, it jumped track back there. The generations, who begat who, sort of like the Bible.
She gave a laugh. You know, you really seem quite with it, not missing a beat. Well, I'm quite impressed. He was pleased, yet felt self-consciousness. Thank God he had some facts to hide behind.
I guess because I've read the poem before and more than once, I mean a few translations. It's sort of like a hobby.
So you got lost?
Well, yes, she said. All those births and deaths, not to mention marriages, affairs.
He didn't know she'd understood quite well, but ego always tries to wag its tail.
Well, there was Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, the wife who bound her eyes to share his blindness.
Pregnant, she then asked the serving maid to bang her belly with a bar, remember?
Margo chuckled. Well, yes, they staged that well, jamming her up and letting that black thing roll out clunk, a ten-pin alley ball.
And then she added, I mean, that's over the top.
I guess it is symbolic, but just imagine how long the story would have been to tell if the 101 sons each had a chapter.
You have a point there, Yogi, she added wryly, the line of her mouth making her eyelids squint. By the way, the family name, what was it?
Yogi was eager to show his little learning.
Well, on the blind king's side, it was Kauravas and the eldest son, Prince Duryodhana. He wants the throne, I guess, to dominate.
That's always the case. You men need your power. But remove it and kiss the epics all goodbye.
He saw then he was stepping between minds. Now she seemed more erudite than him.
And who are those other guys, the banded brothers?
They are the flip side. They are righteousness, the fivefold sons of Pandu. Call them Dharma. They've come to cowboy through the mess, Adharma. They have to set things straight or go down swinging.
Dharma, Adharma, she was now intoning.
So it's more philosophy than epic, and all those Sanskrit names really confusing. She was giving him a platform, the young pony.
Yes, there was some learning curve, but not unlike blind Homer's cast of power action figures, you know, Odysseus and Hector and Achilles alongside Zeus, Athene and Aphrodite. They've also been imaginary friends since young. I've listened to the Argonauts, don't you remember, on the radio?
I guess I should know, but I wasn't born here. We lived in Montreal until the 60s.
He should have listened more instead of spruiking and tried to cover.
Oh, so you're Canadian.
Well, not really. She held back her story.
You've been listening to Foreign Madam and the White Yogi, a verse novel by Chris Mooney Singh. Do check out my website if you want to hear more of my work at chrismooneysingh.com.